Welcome to Local Talk Friday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Paul Wearson.
And I'm Dennis Hart. Happy to be with you, Paul, on this last Friday in August with the Labor Day weekend just ahead.
Yeah, it's the last swan song of summer, and I can tell that because I had the heater on and the weight in the car today. That was terrible, but I'm still wearing shorts.
I noticed this.
And a hoodie.
Yeah.
So you see, I'm observing both summer and fall. Isn't that cute?
I'm not sure what to make of it. I'm not sure it's politically correct in any sense, but those shorts, why do you wear shorts when it's cool out there?
Well, I want to wear shorts till October because now you get to go to California in the winter, but I don't get to do that.
So. I understand. Okay, well, I'm wearing long pants just
so
everybody knows.
It's also a limited wardrobe. I'm on a fixed income.
We have lots in store for today's program, Paul, including an interview with one of the leaders of the campaign against the proposed Healthy Life Center bond issue here in Ames.
And later we'll check in with Ames Police Commander Jason Tuttle about how the department is getting ready for the big crowd at Iowa State University's football season opener tomorrow morning at Jack Trice Stadium. And after that, well, Maggie Westfold will join us with another of her unique takes on life here in Iowa.
But first, with Monday being Labor Day, we are happy to have with us on the phone the president of the Des Moines chapter of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Dan Homan. Dan, welcome to Local Talk on this Friday.
Thank you. Happy Labor Day to you.
You bet. Understand you're in Kansas City. We appreciate your joining us by phone here. Dan, union membership is down as this Labor Day approaches. How healthy is the labor union movement in the United States, do you think?
I think the labor union movement, based on recent studies, is on the rise. Union approval ratings have never been higher or at its highest point, probably in the last 10 to 15 years. And I'm seeing more and more people are wanting to form a union to protect them on the job from unfair practices that employers sometimes do. So I think we're on the rebound.
Well, you know, this is Paul, by the way. Good morning to you. And I'm a history buff, and I realize that for most of the history of America, there was no labor movement, really, and it was laissez-faire economics, and people who owned companies and corporations could really treat employees any way they wanted to. We had 10-year-old boys dying in coal mines, and the labor movement began in the 19th century, and I just think that was necessary. And there's, in history, you know, the pendulum swings one way and then swings the other. As you've noted, the membership's down in the last few years, but you're seeing a resurgence, and I think that's an imbalance of power that's being corrected. What do you think about that?
I would agree wholeheartedly with everything you said, other than that unions are a recent phenomenon. They may be in the public sector, but unions in the public sector in Iowa have existed for over 80 years. We have locals within our council that have been in existence for 80 years, long before there was ever a law. But I think labor got its rise out of several incidents. You had the incident in Chicago. You had the incident in New York where the women seamstress went out on strike.
The Haymarket fire, right? That's also a big...
Yes, sir, where people were locked into the building because the employer thought people were sneaking outside to, I guess, smoke a cigarette. I don't know what they did back in those days. But, you know, let me put it to you this way. I have been an employee of Council 61 for, it'll be 32 years this December, and I have never, ever, ever been called by a group of employees saying to me, "We got the greatest boss in the world. Will you come in and organize a union for us?" Every time that we get a call from a group of employees wanting to unionize, it's because the employer is mistreating them,
Dan,
in any number of ways.
Dan, now unions got a big push, obviously, during the New Deal, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The Wagner Act legally protected the right of unions to organize, and it's waxed and waned since then. The Taft-Hartley Act, still in effect, banned union contributions to political parties. But everything we read right now is that there are fewer private sector employees who are members of a union. It's down to maybe 7 or 8%. What's going on in the private sector vis-a-vis labor unions?
You know, I'm probably not the biggest expert on what's going on in the private sector. I think it is there are people that believe they don't need a union anymore, and then once they figure out they do, it might be too late. But here in Iowa, I think private sector unions are doing okay. The whole labor movement is down. I mean, nationally, I think it's around 10%. But then if you compare that to the public sector, it's in the mid-30s.
Right. So, I think that when you look at history, in my lifetime, certainly when I was a boy, there were strikes, union strikes throughout the economy. And, you know, that was the power of the unions to strike, because that was their power to walk off the job or go into a sit-down or something like that. And nowadays, there are so many options for where you get labor that in the recent years, maybe since 1980, 1990, jobs are moved overseas. If someone threatens to strike, they say, well, if you workers want to have a union, that's fine, but we're going to move the jobs over to China or some foreign country. And that might be overstated, too, because I've been reading that a lot of the job losses are not the result of moving jobs overseas as much as jobs being outmoded by automation and technology. So there are a lot of challenges in the workplace, and I think unions are probably a part of what's happening there, too, right?
I would agree. I would agree with the 2 points that you made. I think automation and the introduction of robots into the workplace have greatly cut down on the needs to have live human beings doing that work. I mean, I will not go to a self-checkout lane in any store. I don't care if I have to stand in line to have that human being check me out for a half hour. I'll stand in that line because I don't work for that company I'm buying those goods for. And the other thing I think that has diminished somewhat is the power of the strike. And I don't know what's it. I think it's because other men and women so desperately want a good paying job that they will cross another person's picket line. When I grew up, my dad was in the union and the trucking industry. My uncle was in the union in the railroad industry. And if they threw up a picket line, nobody crossed that line because they did not want to deal with those angry strikers. Today, a person will walk across the picket line and not give a second thought that they are stealing somebody else's job who has fought for years to make that job what it is. And I just think that's a shame. You know, my dad told me I could do a lot of things when I was growing up. Crossing a picket line was certainly not one that he would favor me doing.
Dan, over the years, a lot of folks have come to believe that unions have primarily supported the Democratic Party and Democratic candidates, and there's been pushback on that. And as you know, last year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that public sector labor unions cannot force non-members to pay dues, because there was some pushback that those dues were being used to support only Democrats and Republicans. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, that's a lie. In Iowa, we cannot use dues money to support any political candidate. We have to create a separate PAC that employees have to give to that PAC voluntarily, and that's the money that we will use to support political candidates. Unfortunately, the majority of the time of the candidates that we support are Democratic because the Republican Party, in my opinion, has lost its way. Let's go back to February 2016 when they voted to gut in the Iowa legislature a law that had been on the books for 44 years. During that entire process, I talked to all the leadership in the Republican House and the Republican Senate, even on a radio show with Jason Schultz, who claimed he had met with me before, and that was the first time I had ever met the man. Hmm. They told us they were not going to make any drastic changes to Chapter 20. They told us that people would be able to have the same type of contracts under the new law that they had under the old law. And those were just flat-out lies. The new law has stripped away the union's ability to bargain a decent contract. State employees went from a 256-page contract to a 26-page contract and one page of words and 25 pages of job classification.
Well, speaking broadly, I think that what you're saying here is a lot of deliberate erosion of labor unions in the public sector. And, of course, we've talked about how few union members exist in the private sector. I think the big thing when you look at the sweep of history is labor versus management. Now, if you have a company or if you're a manager or a proprietor, you have two options in terms of how you view your employees. Are they a resource? Are they your friends? Are there people working in cohabitation with you toward a goal? Or are they a liability and just a cost accounting expense? And I was manager of the employment office in Des Moines for the state of Iowa, and we saw a variety of different relationships and successful employers and employers who had high turnover. And Dr. Deming, who came up with a quality circle management that really revolutionized automaking in Japan and put them ahead of America, he did a study of labor relations, and he found out that in businesses and companies and factories, 20% of the problems and conflicts were sourced by the employees, and over 80% were sourced by management problems. So, you know, he found out a lot about employer or management and unions and how people behave in the workplace. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, we used the Deming experience or program up in the city of Sioux City when I was the union rep, when I lived in Sioux City and was working for the union in Sioux City before I became president. Like I said earlier, an employer's got a couple choices. They can treat their employees fairly and honor their value, or they can treat them like crap. 80 years ago, employers valued the work of their employees, and they shared with their employees the profits of that company. Today, companies aren't sharing with the people that are producing their goods that are making them profitable. CEO wages are up almost 1,000% over the last 10 years or so, and worker wages have gone up only 12% in comparison to CEO wages. There's the problem.
Dan,
companies aren't sharing their own profits with the people that made them profitable.
Dan, I want to wish you a happy Labor Day. We have to go. Thank you so much for joining us on Local Talk today.
You're very welcome. Enjoy the weekend, long weekend that was brought to you by Organized Labor.
You bet. Thanks,
happy
Dan
holiday.
Homan, live from Kansas City on the phone. Don't go away now. We have lots more ahead on Local Talk after this brief time out. We're going to talk with one of the leaders of the campaign against the proposed Healthy Life Center bond referendum here in Ames.
Well, welcome back to Local Talk Friday on KHOI Radio. I'm Paul Wearson.
And I'm Dennis Hart. Joining us now, one of the leaders of the campaign against the proposed Healthy Life Center bond issue here in Ames. His name, Tom Durkin. He is the owner and general manager of Ames Fitness. Tom, welcome to Local Talk.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. The bond issue coming up on September 10th, $29 million in public money to help fund the $49 million Healthy Life Center. What don't you like about this bond issue, Tom?
Oh, there's about four major items that I think are problematic for the city of Ames and for the residents. And I just want to make sure that they're aware of these items before they go to vote. I'm confused. When I first heard about this, they said they were going to raise $18 million privately or there was no vote. As far as I can tell, they raised $5.5 million. My first question is, why are we even voting? So I don't know how that gets pushed through. The second, they want us to vote on a $50 million or more. They have no contract. They have no finalized bid on this building. For instance, the high school was bonded at $110 million. Mm-hmm. When they went into design, that came in at $9 million higher. How can we vote on a building when we don't know the cost? I think the third issue I think that the citizens of Ames would have with this is that two out of the three entities involved in this are supposed to have lifetime subsidization of this facility, but they're contractually in their contract, they can get out of subsidization.
Which two?
Mary Greeley and Story County. Mm-hmm. They can back out of the contract. So why does the taxpayer have to stay on the hook for life for $50 million facility that we do not need when both Mary Greeley can walk away mm-hmm. and Story County can walk away? And I even think they're pro forma. You know, they paid an expert $95,000 for a feasibility study. They got their usage report. They're saying 330,000 people are going to use this facility. I don't believe that. And they got that number from using a three-month, the outdoor aquatic facility here in Ames. It's open 3 months when kids are out of school, when they bring busloads of kids over there for field trips, which is great. But those are not accurate numbers. I mean, you know, my analogy always is that if we were going to build a mall, you wouldn't sit in the mall 1 month out of the year, maybe December, and say, look at all the traffic here, and take that times 12 and say that's going to be the usage. That would be the wrong math. And that's what they're basing this on. So, and even though, and it still loses over $400,000 a year, which according to their own minutes, which I brought you guys copies, it could be higher than that. And if so, they're going to come back to the taxpayer. And those are the issues that I think the city should, or the residents should take a hard look at before you go put your name on a $50 million building that you're going to pay for forever.
Now, the $404,000, that's the operating costs yearly that they're anticipating, right, Tom?
The deficit.
No, that is, deficit. That's going to be the cost. It won't be borne by income. And so that will be taken care of by the taxpayer. Is that correct?
Well, yes. And, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting, you know, they're saying 300,000 of those dollars are for maintenance. Well, of course they're for maintenance. I mean, that's factored in, is that these large facilities cost a lot to run. And so when you hire an expert and pay him money and he does the study, of course you do. And so when they're saying, you know, that's not a real cost or not a real deficit, that's not true. I mean, from their own city manager, these are the risks that the city manager laid out in the last council meeting. And he calls it a risk, and he calls it a deficit, and he calls it a loss, and he said it could be greater. And I'm just saying, how can you vote on something when you don't know the cost of it? Two out of the three entities can get out of jail. You can't. You don't know what the losses are, and there's no need for the darn thing. And we think the numbers, the 330,000, are based on an outdoor pool. I just think they're asking an awful lot, and that's just blind faith. And I don't think you should have just blind faith.
We should add right now that next Friday on this broadcast, Ames Mayor John Hale is going to be here, and we will ask him the exact same questions that you're bringing up here. So I want our listeners to know that we're going to hear from Mayor Hale next Friday. But right now, Tom, one of the questions about the campaign you are running, and it's called CARE. Talk about what's that acronym stand for?
It stands for the Citizens of Ames Responsible Economics. And so I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, okay, you're running that campaign. Some are saying out there that there's a conflict of interest that you have because you own and operate Ames Fitness Centers, which might be in competition with the Healthy Life Center. What's your response to that?
Well, a couple things. First of all, when you raise the taxes on all businesses to pay for something that is not needed, I mean, you know, in my mind, if they're building a public library that the private sector is not going to build, that's fine. You're going to build roads and bridges, that's fine. There's 18 or 19 fitness centers in Ames now. Mm-hmm. Ames is already ranked as one of the fittest cities in America, one of the best places to retire, one of the best places to live. How can you win the awards if there's a need? You're not going to win the awards. You know, I find it interesting, as I was coming over to your station, you know, I read the issue about the parking meters, right. Raising the parking meters.
Right.
I paid for parking to come in here this morning. Mm-hmm. Right? And so the city said, we need to raise more revenue. I believe that to be true. After they raised the parking meters, the shopkeepers, the store owners said, hey, it's hurting business. People don't want to pay that much to park. I believe that to be true. Well, if the city needs more money from the parking meters, why are you building a $50 or $60 million white elephant that loses over $400,000 a year? And number two, if parking meter money hurts these storekeepers down here, which I think it does, what do you think raising their taxes does to them? I just think the whole model should be taken down. You know, if Mary Greeley needs a new pool, they're putting in $7 million. That buys a pretty nice pool. And if Heartland needs a new facility, and I think they probably do, they should have a new facility. But it's not $50 million, and it shouldn't be a burden to the taxpayer forever.
And so really, I remember the parking issue, and this is probably under the heading of unintended consequences.
Right.
Certainly the city needed more revenue, and they thought, boy, if we jack up the price for parking, here's our projected income from that. And it was sort of silo thinking because, yes, that raises revenue, but then the shopkeepers and people you have doing business on Main Street rose up and said, that's not working because it's harming our business and cutting downtown trade. And they had the luxury of reversing that and putting the meters back to a more reasonable cost. And now when you build a facility and you have an existing unit that's costing a lot of money to build, and you said pointing out to everybody here that it's going to cost money to operate, that is something that when you have an unforeseeable consequence, it may not be reversible, like the parking issue.
You're on the hook. You don't get off the hook. And that's the point. Once it's built, it is going to cost a tremendous amount of money to maintain and to run. And they are going to have to come back to the taxpayer time and time again. I'm just saying, vote this down and start over and figure out something that makes sense for Mary Greeley and figure out something that makes sense for Heartland.
Well, one thing I'm concerned about and don't have any knowledge of for sure is whether polling's been done in this issue. Has any polling been done on trying to ascertain what the pre-vote opinion is broadly?
I have no knowledge.
I've never seen any polling yet.
No, there's been no polling on this. This takes 60% voter approval on September 10th. And again, we're talking about a $29 million bond issue. The biggest bond issue, by the way, the biggest non-school bond issue in the history of Ames. And Tom, as you know, that fundraising campaign, the private fundraising campaign, was supposed to raise $18 million. It raised $5.5 million. That money that they didn't raise got pumped into this bond issue. This was never going to be a $29 million bond issue. So I would presume, not putting words in your mouth, one of your issues is that the money that was supposed to be raised privately now has to be borne by taxpayers on the bond issue.
Right. It increases our taxes. And I just don't know how you can change the rules. You know, I think one of the models that they're looking at is a facility in Rochester, Minnesota. Well, first of all, Rochester is 110,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, they had one individual who put in $30 million. Number three, Mayo Clinic is privately owned.
Right.
There's no burden to the taxpayer. There's more people that live there, and one individual person gave $30 million. That is not the case here. So you're going to build a white elephant. It's going to lose more than $400,000. It's going to be a burden on the taxpayer forever. And I just think that Ames residents should vote no.
Mm-hmm. It's not that you're not saying you're opposed to a concept of a healthy life center, are you?
I'm all for fitness.
He owns Healthy Life Center.
You
right,
own a lot of them.
Right. For 40 years, we have tried to get people to exercise and take care of themselves. We're all for the concept, but we are also for financial responsibility.
Paul, we should also note that, and Tom, that this would require a tax hike, $44 more per $100,000 of assessed valuation for residential property, $70 more per $100,000 for business and industrial property. And we should add that that's if the revenue projections come true, that if the attendance is as they say it will be. If it is not, then the likelihood is more money is going to have to, it's going to have to come from somewhere. And you're saying it's going to come from more taxes.
I'm not saying that. I'm reading what the city manager told the city council verbatim, that this $404,000 is just a guesstimate and it could be much higher, and that additional property tax obligation will be required. This is a fact. So I brought the notes with me. I'll be glad to leave them for you.
Yeah, I'd be interested in that because I live in Story City, and so I'm sort of a spectator here. But it's fascinating to hear both sides. In the Tribune, you have very heavy letter traffic to the editor. Mm-hmm. And you can see there's wide variance of opinion. I see the yard signs, mm-hmm. and I see your campaign. I think mm-hmm. you're on the buses and
correct.
On the, all the other means of advertising that's physical out there. And you probably feel that this will be a close vote. Is that true? Do you think it's going to be close?
I hope not, but it may. You know, I just want the residents of Ames to know what they're voting on. And right now, you know, at that meeting, I think that you were at just the other day, one of the representatives from Heartland said they are already contemplating expanding this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the meeting you're talking about, Tom, took place yesterday at the library. It's one of several public meetings that the city's putting on. About 50 or 60 people were there. I was there as well. And I will say that there was healthy skepticism about the center and the cost from the audience. Many of the questions revolved around the cost and why it has to be, and we'll ask the mayor this next Friday, $50 million worth of Healthy Life Center. Could it not be less expensive?
Right.
Once the private fundraising did not make the $18 million, why wasn't there an effort to cut down the price of the Healthy Life Center? There was no effort on that.
That's right. And so that just seems to me that that's the part that's not responsible. And that's why there should be a no vote. And they can reboot this thing and look at it and come up with something that that makes more sense financially.
Well, I think built into the guidelines of voting for bond issues, 60% is a high bar. You know, we have so many close 60. Elections these yeah. days in the political world that it's hard to get 51%. So it should be a high bar if you're talking about taxes and city policy and all the expenses involved and trying to project the future based on what we know and don't know. And there are always unknowables, always things that are under the heading of unintended consequences. And so I feel that it should be a high bar. It should be 60% because you can't have 51% of the people against something or for something and something gets built and you don't have that kind of support, then you're really in trouble. So 60% I think is a great idea. So it might sound like a high bar, but if that kind of money is going to be spent and that kind of investment of money is going to be occurring, then it better be a high bar. And so I would say that maybe it's going to be a close vote, but it's going to be hard to get over that hump, I think.
Tom, sum up in the last 30 seconds that we have here, and you are an articulate spokesman for the campaign that you're running. Sum up your feelings about this. Why are you opposing this bond issue?
There's too many unknowns. You don't know the price of what it's going to cost to build it. You don't know how much money it's going to lose. You don't know if the two entities are going to stay in and subsidize it. And if not, it's going to raise the citizens of Ames taxes forever. And there's no need for it. we've already got 33 awards on the Ask the Mayor on the website. So there's no need. It's overpriced. When we first met, when Heartland and I first met, this was a $5 million project. Mm-hmm. I asked him 2 years later, I said, what happened to it? They said the budget got out of control. That's difficult to go from $5 million to $50 million. That's irresponsible.
I'd like to see my income grow that way.
It's excessive, and that's why it's a no vote.
Tom, thanks so much for being with us today. The vote is September 10th. On a $29 million bond referendum in the city of Ames. Next Friday at this hour, we'll have Mayor John Hala on to give his point of view about why they're supporting, why the city is backing this. Thanks, Tom, very much for being here.
Well, that's one of the reasons I love living in America. We're going to present both sides of the issue, yep. And both people, I'm sure, will be making their best efforts to convince everyone of their point of view. And that's lively debate, and
indeed.
I love it, and that's part of radio. And thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You make a strong case.
Stay tuned now. There is much more ahead on Local Talk up next. We're going to speak with Ames Police Commander Jason Tuttle, who's on the line with us right now waiting to go on. But we're going to take a short break, and then he's going to tell us how the department's going to handle all of you who are going to show up for tomorrow's Iowa State home football opener. Be right back. We are back on Local Talk Friday on KHOI Radio. It is 32 minutes after the hour, or 28 minutes before the top of the hour, however you want to put it. I'm Dennis Hart.
And I'm Paul Wearson. Iowa State University opens its football season tomorrow at Jack Trice Stadium with an 11 o'clock in the morning game against the University of Northern Iowa. And thousands of fans will be here. Joining us on the phone now, Ames Police Commander Jason Tuttle. Jason, how is the department gearing up for the game?
Well, first of all, I think we're getting our sleep tonight.
That's a good idea.
For tomorrow. You know, we've been preparing for weeks with Iowa State Police, State Patrol, some of our other partners, and making sure we're going to provide a safe game day for everyone who comes to visit Ames and to see our team win tomorrow. But, you know, starting off, we actually have extra staffing out tonight. To deal with some of our visitors will come in town. They'll visit our bar area, and they'll be out and about. And then at 8 o'clock in the morning, our traffic officers, along with the other officers from the other jurisdictions, will start directing traffic to try to get people into town safely in the morning.
Let's talk about what you do and how you're going to handle the occasion, and I'm sure this happens more than once, at the tailgating before the game, Jason, when people perhaps have a few too many adult beverages. What can you do and what do you do about that?
Yeah, you know, a lot of that enforcement goes to the ISU Police Department. We don't do a lot of, we don't put our people out in the tailgate lots, but we do have our officers in some of the other city-owned areas around the stadium. And so we're always looking out for people that mainly our goal, again, for a game day is safety. And so if you are so intoxicated, you're not in control of yourself, you're a danger to yourself, we're probably going to talk to you and you may go to jail. You also, on a city-owned street, you cannot walk around and consume alcohol on a public sidewalk or a public roadway. The rules are a little bit different when you're inside the tailgating area on Iowa State property. But if you're walking from one of those private lots on South 4th Street over to the stadium, you're not supposed to have an open can of beer. And so those rules don't change for us on game day weekends. Again, they're a little bit different on Iowa State property. But again, in the end, it really does come down to safety. Well, we want people to have fun, but we also want them to be responsible. We want them to have a great day, but in the end, we want them to go home safe at the end of the night.
Well, so many people who attend regularly have their place to tailgate off campus. There are several areas and parking areas that I'm sure people are accustomed to using because they've gone to games for years. Is there any area out there in the city around the environs of the stadium that are changing in terms of availability this year? Are there changes in where you can park?
Yeah, there are a few small ones. I know one for sure. There's a little parking lot off of South 4th at Stuart Smith Park, kind of right behind that little welcome center on University. That lot will not be available for people because of the construction around the stadium. ISU Police has reserved that lot for law enforcement parking, and so we know for sure that won't be available. I know they've reduced some of the parking because of the construction they're doing on the intramural fields there, but in the end, there's still going to be plenty of parking available. As you probably have heard, we will be out and about with our parking officers, and where our fines are increasing in those areas around the football stadium to $40 on game days. So what happened before was folks would not want to pay to park in some of those private lots, so they would park on a city street, and they would get the $20 ticket, and they would rather pay that rather than park in those private lots because sometimes the streets are closer. And so our permanent residents have complained a lot about that over the years because it makes those side streets very compacted. It's hard for us to get ambulances and fire trucks down some of those streets when there's cars are parked on both sides. So those fines have been raised. And so we're interested to see if that pushes some of these folks into some of those areas or if they're just going to continue to park there and just be willing to pay that $40 ticket because it's convenient.
Jason, I know that $20 fine hasn't terribly been effective for those neighbors,
no.
And it drives the neighbors just absolutely crazy. But here's my question. You've raised it starting tomorrow, and people need to know this, $40 for a fine. How many of those people who actually get tickets just walk on the fines, never pay them? Do you know?
I don't know. We do get a number of those. I can tell you on an average game day, we will average 400 to 500 tickets we will write across
wow.
the city, not just necessarily in that game impacted area. And we've even on a busier game day, we've written closer to 700 to 800. That's when we had a full time parking officer that worked the west side of town. So he's not here anymore, but all of our parking officers are part time other than our supervisor. But so, you know, we will be writing quite a few tickets. We're interested at the end of the year to see what we're going to compare our numbers to see, was it a deterrent effect? Are we getting more positive feedback from some of those residents that live in those areas? So we'll look at all that information at the end of the year to determine really how effective this ordinance was. And I'm sure the council will probably want to know that too. We always want to look at data to make sure we're making the correct decisions in everything we do.
Well, Jason, those numbers knocked me off my chair.
Yeah.
All those hundreds of tickets written. And I do think that upping the fine probably will have an impact. Of course, you'll see that after the season is over and you can analyze that figure. But apparently some people are just eating that price to see the game. Now, what time do people start streaming into Ames on a game day where the game is 11 a.m.?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the parking lots, I believe, they open 6 hours prior to kickoff. So we'll start seeing people flow into town probably 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I would guess we'll probably hit our busy stretch probably around 8 to 9 o'clock in the morning. And generally that last half hour, 45 minutes leading up to kickoff, the traffic may not be as heavy. But the earlier kickoffs, it compresses that time frame for people to arrive in town. So we still could be, busy throughout the morning, quite busy throughout the morning. Generally what we see with the later kickoffs, they may come later in the morning or some people may come the night before. You and I, the fans, are closer. But either way, it's going to be a very busy day for us. We plan to have adequate officers out at those intersections to help people to get in town safely. But it just takes that one accident on Highway 30 or on University Drive to muck up traffic for miles and miles.
I asked you about people who imbibe too many adult beverages before the game. What about after the game? Do you have a significant problem with, shall we say, drunk drivers after a typical football game?
We do. We generally arrest a handful of people after every game for OWI. And so we will have extra staffing out, too, after the game because, we not only have to worry about the night before the game, we have to have staffing at the game. And then a lot of those people go to Welch Avenue and the Main Street bars afterwards, and they'll drink until 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
And so we'll have some foot teams on Welch Avenue, some bike patrol teams out there. Of course, we'll have our officers in their vehicles out patrolling. But, one OWI will take an officer off the street for probably 2 hours.
Mm.
So you can see we have limited resources to start off with. But when we have a drunk driver that hits a car or hits people or you know, they're swerving all over the road and we arrest them, that takes an officer off the street for a considerable amount of time. So to me, it's simple. There's plenty of these rideshare programs, Uber, Lyft, a taxi, Skyride, responsible friends can take you home. There's no reason in today's age people should be drinking and driving.
Right.
Well, I recommend Skyride. When I've gone to Iowa State games, I park at the North Grand Mall, get on Skyride. They take you right down there. It's a short walk to the stadium through the tailgating area. And I'm always safe, sound, and not driving in congested traffic.
Yep.
My pet peeve is running my engine blocked in traffic.
Right.
I'm not a New York or California person. I don't like that. So I really appreciate Skyride. I'm giving them a recommendation here just for the sheer convenience of it.
And you're you're perfectly right. North Grand Mall is a great place for people to park. There are other parking lots around town where you can hop on Skyride. Please don't park in the Kmart lot on South Duff because we've had that problem for years. You'll get towed if you park there. That's a privately owned parking lot. But Brookside Park is another great place to park. There's a parking lot here downtown at City Hall on the weekends that you know that you can use. And so there, and we have a Skyride, you know, a bus stop on the south side of City Hall. So again, it's there are plenty of other options to get into the stadium.
Jason, we have to go. I want to thank you for being with us today on KHOI. A pleasure talking with you both before this broadcast and during it. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Good
Jason
luck tomorrow. Good luck tomorrow.
Ames Police Commander, going to be a wild day out there, Paul. We hope it's not too wild.
No, I hope so. I think everyone should be responsible and focus on the football game. I'm really a football guy. My high school team opens tonight. All my boys from Roland Story, the Norsemen, risking life and limb against another team, and I'll be out tonight. And I'll be comfortably ensconced by my TV tomorrow to watch Iowa and Iowa State.
There you go.
Happy days.
You bet. Hey, let's take a look now at a brief, Lee, of what made news this past week from the pages of the Ames Tribune. Normally we do this off the top of the show, but we had a lot of guests here today. And so Maggie Westvoldt's with us, going to be here just after I finish this. Big story last Saturday in the Tribune, the sentencing of the homeless man who admitted fatally stabbing Iowa State University student Celia Barcana Rosamena. A judge sentenced 22-year-old Colin Richards to life in prison without parole. Barcana Rosamena was also 22. She was a civil engineering student and one of Iowa State's best golfers ever when she was killed at the Coldwater Golf Links last year. Sunday brought word that officials at Iowa State University, or rather Iowa University campuses, are trying to navigate their way through the new state law that legalized gambling on college athletics. NCAA rules still keep athletes and coaches from betting, but there's concern that members of the general public who want to place bets on games could reach out to athletes for information about such things as who's injured and about who may not be playing in those games. Tuesday brought word that the Ames School Board had approved 18 bids for the new Ames High School project on Monday. Those bids came in more than $3 million under the estimated budget. Total amount was more than $90 million. Now, the school's going to cost more than that, and more bids are going to be voted on later. Also Tuesday, word that the filing period for candidates for the Ames City Council and the Ames School Board had opened on Monday. Filing can take place until 5 o'clock, September 19th. Election Day, November 5th. Wednesday brought more news about this week's Ames School Board meeting, where the board voted to put a temporary shot put and discus field for the high school's track and field program at Fellows Elementary. It's going to be a temporary field, cost about $60,000. The old field was at the high school, but it's been displaced by construction for the new Ames High School. There was also a report that everyone who plans to attend tomorrow's Iowa State football home opener should be aware of. We just talked about it with Jason Tuttle. City of Ames cracking down hard on drivers who park their cars on streets near Jack Trice Stadium. Parking fines are going from $20 to $40. Be aware of that. One more note from Wednesday, word that a new feature is going to be added to next month's Octagon Art Festival here in Ames, going to be a Chalk the Block contest, encouraging artists to show off their skills in the 400 block of Burnett. I have no chalk the walk skills. Yesterday brought word that an Ames shopping center had unfortunately been vandalized with graffiti. The center in the 800 block of South Duff was sprayed with blue paint. Three males, all juveniles who had run away from the local youth shelter, were being questioned. There was also a story that Iowa teenagers are being vaccinated at a higher percentage compared to teens in many other states around the Midwest and the nation. Here in Story County, 98% of teenagers have been vaccinated. And there was word that big-time progress has been made in the construction of the new Fairway grocery store at 6th and Burnett in downtown Ames. You can see it yourself. The store's walls have gone up, and the goal is to have the new building enclosed before winter. Company officials hope to open the new 24,000-square-foot Fairway next February. Yep, it takes more time to fix the inside than it does to put up the walls on the outside. Today brought word in the Trib that a Boone woman had died in a two-vehicle crash on U.S. Highway 30 at State Street in Ames on Wednesday, the victim, 83-year-old Nancy Dean. Today's paper also reported that Story County supervisors had approved a speed limit change for part of Cameron School Road. Listen up. The first quarter mile west of George Washington Carver is going to be 30 miles an hour. The second quarter mile, 40 miles an hour. The current speed limit is 50 miles an hour. And there's a story today that likely is going to surprise no one. New research from Iowa State University reveals that people are more likely to be unhappy with their house if it is a smaller house than the one next door. Well, okay. That's your summary of the week's news, but we're not done yet. After this brief time out with the musical interlude, Maggie Westfold is going to be here, and you're not going to want to miss what she has to say about life right here in Iowa. Stay tuned.
Back with more of Local Talk Friday. And joining us now is one of our favorite people, Maggie Westfold, who always delights us with her unique looks at life here in Iowa. Maggie.
Hello, KHOI listeners and Dennis and Paul. It's nice to be back. I recently read that tryouts are going to be held for a movie to be made about the phenomenon that was 6-on-6 girls basketball in Iowa. I'm guessing that those young actresses who will be cast to play the roles of those dribbling those basketballs will only know by hearsay what the game was all about. Sadly, that game went by the wayside when Title IX dictated that girls in Iowa have opportunities for scholarship funds, like in other states around the country, playing our modern-day game of 5-on-5. I was a lucky kid. I played 6-on-6 all through junior high and high school, and I was in several other extracurricular activities as well, but I assure you that playing basketball was my passion. It kept me interested in going to school and keeping my grades respectable. We had a ball, pun intended. I attended Colo High School before the merger, which created Colonesco Schools. We were the CHS Blue Devilettes, and what we lacked in raw talent, we made up for in knowing how to have fun bouncing a basketball. Our gym floor was painted concrete. Yes, listeners, ouch, if and when you went down. Many a front tooth or pair of glasses were lost on that unforgiving surface. I was a forward, and I played mostly at the post position, down underneath where it could get pretty physical now and then. My favorite move was a hook shot, a move that is nearly impossible to defend or to stop. If all those bodies would have just gotten out of my way, I could have scored all night long going either direction. Once in a while, Coach would move me out front, and I liked the freedom out there where I didn't get knocked around quite so much, but my scoring always told the story. I was more effective underneath. Vivid memories from those days start with a practice session when I was a freshman. My sister-in-law-to-be, Rita, was an all-state honorable mention guard, so you know she was good. I once stood at the halfway line, watching the action down the floor, only to see Rita snatch a rebound underneath the basket, take those two allowed dribbles to clear herself of a bit of traffic, jump straight up, and beam that basketball my way like an orange bullet trajectory. Yikes! I managed to catch that thing, but I can still feel the strength behind it. She had farm girl forearm muscles, and she threw a basketball like a softball. It was a good lesson for a nervous, trembling freshman to learn early on, for sure. My all-time favorite win was definitely our victory over the Nevada Cubettes in the sectional tournament championship game in 1962. Nothing was more fun than beating our arch rival, which did not happen often. I was a sophomore, and I spent most of my time warming that bench, so when our starting post forward got into foul trouble and I was called on to help out and give her a rest, To say I was nervous is an understatement. It's those experiences that stick forever in a kid's memory. I can literally still see the beady eyes of that guard defending against me as I shot over her head, and miracle of miracles, watched that ball bobble around and plop through the hoop. I wasn't in that game for long, but the good fortune to score during those 3 or 4 minutes burned the memory in my mind for a lifetime. And we went on to win that game. The Corsages waiting for the Cubettes on their bench likely were lackluster, given a loss. Someone always has to lose, and it was so great to have the Blue Devilettes win that one. One of our coaches could sing like Johnny Mathis. His deal with us players was that following any game that we won, he'd sing for us on the bus on the way home. I don't remember a lot of singing, sad to say, but I still remember it was a lot of fun. I look forward to the movie that's coming and watching to see if they can project on the screen the thrill that was 6-on-6 in Iowa.
I know Paul wants to jump in on the, I know Paul wants to jump in on this, but I got to tell you, this was so delightful to hear this. Paul and I are just beaming. This is one of the best commentaries you've had, and you've had great ones.
Oh, well, thank you.
You were a Blue Devilette.
I was. We wow. All the team, the girls' teams had those kinds of names.
Yeah, like everything had to be feminized. We were the Story City Vikings, and the girls were the Vi-Queens.
Oh.
Now, that means that it was probably a helmet without horns. I don't know.
Do you remember the Everly Cattle Feeders?
Oh,
the girls,
no.
Those girls had, that was a macho name for girls.
But, you know, through the girls... were the first ones to go to the state tournament. The boys hadn't gone for a long time. And the whole town of Story City just emptied out. What an opportunity for burglars, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Story City was just vacant. You could roll a bowling ball down the street and not hit a car. Mm-hmm. And everyone got behind the Vi-Queens. And you're right, these names that feminized the Cubettes.
You know,
yes.
that just sounds like a small drawer in a bar or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, the main thing is my mother played... Actually, Texas and Iowa were the first to have girls' basketball or any kind of girls' sports. She played in 1924-25.
Hmm.
And in that rule, you had the guard court and the offensive court. Then there were two girls in the center that you passed to. Because everyone knows if girls run, they're not going to be able to have babies in the future. And so that was the toned-down, unathletic, and there were only two dribbles allowed, right, Maggie?
Right. You had
only
to use
two
those.
Dribbles.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Only two.
Maggie, all of this took place more than a half century ago, and you recounted it so vividly as if you brought us into it. Obviously, this impacted your life in a terribly positive way.
I
remember this all your life.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of fun. I was a tomboy kid, so basketball was a given, and it wasn't easy for my parents. We live in the country, so you're running in and out of into town, and transportation was always a problem, but they never said you can't do this, and I've always been so grateful for that.
Wow.
And I think it's fitting. It was in Iowa and in Texas. You had all these farm girls who actually did chores and worked on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
Small extension to play a boy's sport.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We can do that. And I'm still having visions in my mind of the Cubettes throwing away their corsages and going through a midlife crisis
tears.
At 17.
There were big tears.
But you don't seem unhappy about that, recounting that, those tears, right?
Not for them, no.
To me, there's nothing sadder than a homeless corsage.
There you go. Maggie Westville, your pieces at the end of Local Talk are priceless. We cannot thank you enough for continuing to do this, and expect to have you back. You're taking next week
thank
off,
you.
Though,
gonna
aren't
you?
Going
to be gone for a couple weeks, but I hope to get back.
I'm afraid that Maggie will get a call from PBS.
There you go.
And we'll lose her.
Gosh.
You know, that'd be terrible.
Or we're going to lose her to CBS with the On the Road thing. She's going to be the new On the Road correspondent instead of that Steve Hartnett.
You guys.
Hey, it's time for us to go. You have been listening to Local Talk Friday. I must be Dennis Hart.
And I'm Paul Wearson. Local Talk also airs today at noon and 5 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. And you can hear a recording of the show later today online at khoifm.org as well. Find links also to guests and information you heard during our program. Also remember that KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org.
As always, our theme song is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley, and a great lady she was indeed. You need to know about Kate Shelley. Local Talk's a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, We'll train you. Come on down, join our local talk team.
And also remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio. Have a great weekend.